You're listening to the Youth Critic Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network.
Simply extraordinary.
And now for the podcast.
Maybe this will all make sense if I explain who I am.
My name is Dr. Ellie Staple, and I'm a psychiatrist. My work concerns a particular type of delusion of grandeur. It's a growing field. I specialize in those individuals who believe they are superheroes.
Good for you.
The three of you've convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book. David Dunn, the only person to survive that train wreck all those years ago.
What do you do?
I'm in security.
You think you have superpowers?
It's a feeling. Vision. I have to touch them.
You believe you are a protector.
My name is Patricia.
I have no question. There are 24 identities.
I'm Mary Reynolds.
Por favor, señora.
We almost got you, bro.
That live in that body with you.
The beast is coming any minute now for you guys.
But what I am questioning is your belief that you are something more than human.
And yet, it is true.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast. I'm your host, Kel Smith. Joining me today is Gina Versa.
Hello.
And today we are going to be talking about Glass, M. Night Shyamalan's final film in the Unbreakable trilogy, and the Eastrail trilogy, all those things. Gene, without going into spoilers, what did you think of Glass?
I really enjoyed it as a film, and I felt that this is one of M. Night's most stylized, well-crafted, one of his in his catalog of movies. This one really impressed me. I'm totally on that M. Night Shyamalan resurgence, his renaissance, if you will. I saw this early a week before it came out at Beyond Fest, and I said I really enjoyed it in a movie, but also as this capstone and this end to the Eastrail 177 trilogy. It's pretty magnificent of an ending, and I really appreciated the empathy that M. Night shows in this movie, and just in general as well, because he's just a very empathetic filmmaker. That, you know, because one or two, you know, bad movies, that happens, it's understandable. He has like a really bad rep, really bad rep. So it's just like, I'm glad that finally it seems like everyone's been appreciating them. And I rewatched this in IMAX, and it looks great in IMAX. So I'd really recommend that to anyone. Went off on a tangent there, but yeah, I was really enjoying this movie second time around.
So my problem, or my thing with Glass, is that I think it's an excellent film. I think it has a great finale to the, you know, to the trilogy, especially as a trilogy that's about empathy and acceptance towards people of mental illness, as this trilogy is kind of formed to be. And while I do have my faults, I think the issue with the movie is more or less people's expectations. I think in a movie where, you know, it is comic booky, and it's also in its DNA, like, it's got the comic book movie structure, it has the structure, but And also, it was promoted as such a big comic book movie epic crossover. And I think people's expectations were they wanted a bigger movie, whereas Glass is very much a smaller, more interesting movie versus, you know, something that we always get like at least once a month now when we're seeing these comic book movies. But I think what people misunderstand about M. Night Shyamalan is at his best when he's character-centric, when he's minimal, and when, you know, he is in just, you know, rooms and people just sitting down.
Yeah.
And characters are talking. So for him to do a big blockbuster action climax for Glass, I think would have been a disservice. I think it would have totally fallen flat even more than, you know, what people are already talking about. Because M. Night Shyamalan's just not that kind. He's not an action filmmaker.
Yeah.
He's more of a horror filmmaker.
Right. I would say, though, that how he
so
action. Oh, I was going to say how he shoots action and this movie is very impressive as well, where it's like a lot of like point of view shots and a lot of like interesting angles in like the battle between the Horde and Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, who is the overseer, right?
I think that's what they title him in this movie. Yeah. That's what this universe like gives him as his vigilante name.
Right, it's better than the Tiptoe Man.
Yeah. Don't ever say the Tiptoe Man again.
You know what? It was did you like the name the Overseer?
I did. I wouldn't have picked it for that character. But I mean, he really is. But that character really does, like, in his actions, just over people, and he finds them through the act of, you know, of essentially their, you know, their past, overseeing their, you know, their what they do.
Right. Right.
You know, that's, you know, or what they're going to do. So for him, you know, the overseer fits. It fits just again, this is a comic book movie, so, or a deconstruction of a comic book movie, works to have something, you know, simplistic for that character.
Right.
I can't stress enough, you know, these movies are simplistic.
I was just gonna add that I would have really thought that, because I, you know, I saw it in a trilogy, and I believe one of the comics he reads in the first one was called like the Sentry, when he's the hero's fighting like the Brute on one of the covers, and it's called the Sentry. So I was like, oh yeah, it's gonna be called that. And I don't know, I thought that would have been an interesting callback if he was called the Sentry or so, and instead of Overseer.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, it just sounds awkward to me.
I mean, some of this, again, in my Shyamalan, it's kind of awkward in his presentation. So it fits just, again, the way to look at Glass is you kind of have to look at it on the character and then what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and instead of, you know, what you were marketed as. Because I feel like the marketing does do a little bit of a disservice to his promoted such as like this epic showdown.
Right.
You know, to the climax of this, they're like, oh my God, they're going to, David Dunn and the Overseer and the Horde are going to fight on top of a, you know, of a building, epic and cool, which, mild spoiler, never happens. So I think, you know, I think the kind of the backlash for Glass is, you know, people nit on what the movie's merits are or what the movie's trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Glass is going to be discussed more because of, you know, what it's trying to do. And really it's very same vein of it's a slash dissection of these previous two films.
Yeah, it's I mean, I really think that some of the discourse on this movie is a little, I don't know, it feels kind of misguided and at times, I don't know, a little lazy, I guess, or it's like, oh, I hated this, and it's like, this one aspect of the ending makes this movie terrible, and it's like, well, then you just didn't like that particular part, it wasn't a bad movie, it was just you didn't agree with that, and like, you know, just some of the, you know, some of the discourse you wish could be a bit better at times.
Well, I mean, the movie has faults, or it has, like, again, M. Night Shyamalan, the movie still reeks of Shyamalan's ego, because Shyamalan just cannot let the fact that overriding expectations or bringing up a trope, like he has to kind of bring it up. Mm-hmm. In a movie like Deadpool, it could work because, I mean, that's that character. But the problem with, you know, this trilogy is it's built up as this very grounded, very minimalistic, down to earth trilogy. Some of these characters point out, you know, things like, and this is where the bad guys are teaming up, or oh, how alliances have changed, stuff like that. It's a little bit like, there's a comic book movie every month, we get it. In April there's going to be three, so yeah. We get it, we get the tropes you're bringing up, you don't have to, you know, spell it out for us. This isn't 2000.
Yeah, exactly.
I just feel that that's a sticking point, and a little bit more so, I wish we had spent a more time with the character, like in their cells, because to me the most interesting parts of the movie is when we're focused on the characters grappling on with the ideas of if they are really or not. Mm-hmm. But the movie focuses a lot more on Ellie Staple or Sarah Paulson's character more than, you know, just kind of. And for me, I think that's a loss. I think M. Night really should have. I think he had a really interesting subplot with David Dunn coming to terms with, you know, am I really a superhuman, or is this a, you know, a psychological brain hemorrhaging thing that was created from the concussion in the train crash, mm-hmm. or the train derailment in the first movie?
Yeah, that was I don't know if we could get into spoilers yet. It's a really long to talk about that.
Let's get into the spoilers. So everyone, if you haven't seen Glass, I think you end it. So just come stay for spoilers. That's great. Please do. If you haven't seen the movie, don't bother. go ahead. What did you want to say?
I really like the trajectory of his character, where he's very much like dark. The Dark Knight Returns of his kind of superhero career. He's old, he's like bitter, his wife died, which I wish they elaborated on that a little more. It feels like that was left out. I don't know if you got that feeling because the original actress didn't come back for whatever reason.
Robin Wright.
Yeah, that was weird. But yeah, I think Bruce Willis does a pretty good job, and you know, this is someone that has been notorious for phoning in a lot of his performances. So yeah, I really appreciated his arc in this movie, and yeah.
It's not. I mean, he's not given a whole lot to do, thankfully. Like, but he does have a subplot that gets really shortened, or it becomes, you know, next to nothing. And I wonder if that's more scenes like Willis just wasn't handling it. M. Night was hoping, and so they had to cut it down. Or
yeah, I felt like there was some more stuff with Audrey.
Or was M. Night really compelled by Ellie Staples' investigation / dissection into all three of these characters? And that seems to be my big issue with the movie, is that there's all these different characters that we've come to know, and all these different, you know, things that we've known about these characters, and they're all going through different breakdowns because of Ellie Staple, you know, in that, you know, she is basically our, she's basically the one, you know, questioning everyone. And we see her questioning everyone. However, we don't see everyone, like, in their own space questioning, you know, their own sanity that much. We only get snippets of, you know, of what they, you know, think they've seen, and or what they believe. I mean, in this movie, there it becomes a minor subplot where Patricia, one of Kevin Wendell Crom's personalities, she becomes, you know, a believer in that, you know, she doubts herself, you know, if the Horde is really as powerful and as strong of a force as, you know, she was led to believe. And that's a very interesting arc, but that only happens in 1.5 scenes. And then you have, you know, only 2 or 3 scenes of, you know, David Dunn, you know, contemplating, you know, his whole life, and even kind of looking back at, you know, his wife's passing and everything that was there for that. And then you have Elijah Price, you know, muted, you know, for half of the movie, so he doesn't even have a voice. So for over half of the movie, we have this one character who we haven't been following, and she just keeps making the same points over and over with each character, just with, you know, different variations, but really going to the same point. And for me, I find that a little disappointing in a movie that is supposed to be a crossover. Maybe not, you know, epic in the terms of, like, Civil War, but or an Avengers movie, but still it feels like a wasted opportunity. And I think that's kind of, and for me, that's the fault of the movie. Even if the, for me, I don't know, I love the ideas in there. It's just, it's, you have to, there's this B plot with Ellie Staple that you have to kind of beat around the bush about, because that also is shrouded with a big spoiler.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Twist point. And for me, the, you know, I guess just kind of jumping to the end, Ellie Staple is a part of the secret organization.
Right. And that was a pretty dramatic twist, I'll admit to that. But I was just going to add that I actually really enjoyed the Ellie Staple parts, because it felt, I felt that the Ellie Staple character was very good at representing almost institutions or these pillars of society that keep people down, that keep a lot of, you know, the broken, as they say in the movie, they keep them, like, you know, complacent, or they keep them sedated. And that goes to the twist, where the twist really worked for me, because, you know, a lot of, like, institutions say, like, a lot of institutions work as these, almost like a secret society, where it's just like, you know, say, like forms of government, you know, they, like, oppress people, or, you know, mental institutions, you know, they misdiagnose people or they mistreat people, and the level of control they have over certain types of people, they almost, like, feel like a secret society, like an Illuminati, if
right,
you will.
Of course, exactly. I mean, right, exactly. I mean, you can make an example to Ellie Staple as a character that is still working off of archaic language as well, or archaic, you know, mental health sciences, in that, you know, she believes she's, you know, she has, you know, all these explanations, all these answers. However, you know, in the end, you know, she just doesn't realize the full capabilities of these people, and she doesn't realize that these are more exceptionalities than, you know, disabilities. And and you can say that's the movie's, you know, dig to how we've treated, you know, or how little we've, you know, given serious, you know, thought into mental health sciences, especially in the climate today, where, you know, we still have, you know, the suicide rate is high, and we just have all these, you know, different problems, and that's where, you know, you have all these, and it all goes, you know, to the idea, and all of this contributes to, you know, the insecurities that people, that Kevin Wendell Crumb and all of his personalities feel, as, you know, they all feel different in that they're all, you know, part of one body, but they all inhabit him. And then you have, you know, people like Anya Taylor-Joy's character, you know, in that same boat as well. So it all accumulates to a very interesting ideas. However, I still feel like Ellie Staple as a character just kind of keeps repeating the same things, because of reasons. And also to build to a subverting, expectating twist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So did you like the ending? Did you, what are your thoughts?
The ending itself is, to me, I really liked the ending. I liked all the twists. I mean, I keep going back and forth on how I feel about the twist that Ellie Staple's part of the secret society, even though I'm very, very well aware that, you know, this happens in comic books all the time, and even Elijah makes a point again about this. I think it's fine. I think, you know, overall, it's a good twist. Or all three of them are. Normally, I would think the connection between Kevin Wendell Crumb's father being on the same train as David Dunn when, you know, the train derailment happened, I would normally think that would be kind of making the world small. But again, taking, you know, the movie on its own merits, this whole universe is very small. It all only happens in Philadelphia. So, you know, so it's not a world ender, and also it builds an even bigger connection that, you know, that tragedy sparks, you know, heroes and villains. It sparks different kinds of people. It's basically the birth of all heroes and villains, and it creates a very interesting kind of side twist, and it does. And it does give Elijah a little bit of a god complex. I don't know. The ending itself, like, I loved all the revelations. It was very, very interesting that they killed all the characters, all three of the, you know, titular characters in, you know, one fatal swoop in one scene. However, I still like the ending, and I love where it goes in that, you know, final shot, even though I get the controversy behind the final shot of, like, well, you know, isn't Glass the villain, and he's kind of getting this hurrah moment. It's really more of a hurrah moment for all three of these characters, and it's all, you know, of these family members, you know, who have lost, you know, these people with extreme exceptionalities because society didn't want them, hence the secret society. So now, and, you know, at the end of the movie, when, you know, Glass's recordings of, you know, David and the Hordes fight, is revealed, it's a really nice touching ending. It's a really nice, you know, very touching ending that, you know, these people have, you know, lost the people they loved, and now they get to, you know, share their memory and spread it, you know, and by honoring them. To me, it's, you know, it's a very heartfelt and very nice ending to a trilogy that's basically nothing but empathy, and has nothing but empathy for its characters. And not just the three, you know, superpowered beings, but the other three characters that, you know, have been around, you know, the other three, the three supporting characters. So, my thoughts on the ending are, I think it was a great ending. Is it a little, you know, cheesy? Yes. Is it controversial? Yes. But I stand by that, you know, I think M. Night Shyamalan crafted the perfect ending, you know, in that it's sad, but there's still a bittersweetness to it.
You know, the thing with Elijah, where it's like, it goes back to this, like, Joker complaint in The Dark Knight, where it's like, oh, he's able to predict everything and everyone and, you know, all this. But, you know, again, it goes to where this is a fictional character in a very exaggerated world. You know, he has a certain superpower in his intelligence, which, you know, is confirmed when she checks his frontal lobe. And yeah, I think it isn't too difficult to, I don't know, accept that twist. You know, it almost reminds
me. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's not.
Yeah, I don't know. It almost reminds me of Dark Knight Rises, where it's like, how does he get back to Gotham?
Well, to go more further into my point, it's not to me necessarily a plot hole in that regard. It's more of a, like, where people are coming from that, you know, he is the villain of the story, and he kind of got. But to me, the way I look at, you know, the ending is all of these people, or, you know, Elijah's mother, Anya Taylor-Cook's character, and David Dunn's son, all, you know, impacted by these people in some way, and they're all together at the end to honor them, to honor their and to honor, look at these people as like people, you know, who have, you know, just never had the chance, to should have never been able to, like, get voices heard, and now their voice is being heard. So together, them holding their hands, commemorating the honor of their memory. Yes, yeah. Set it up, and he is the villain, technically. This is these three characters commemorating their memory. They didn't die in vain. They didn't die at the service of protecting this secret society's goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That's why the ending works for me, is that it's, in the end, it's these three characters, they're memorializing, and they're watching them memorialize the people they loved.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, that's like the most empathetic, most pure moment of the entire trilogy. Watching the world, watch their father or their son, or for Anya Taylor-Joy, her friend, or like them in action and their memory not being lost or forgotten, which is very powerful. It's a very powerful ending. So with that, Gene, is there any more to say on Glass?
No, I don't think so. I was very happy with it, and it's the story M. Night wanted to tell, and he got to tell it, and I think as the storyteller of all the three films, he did an amazing job. So
I mean, I think there are certain faults in this one that in his previous bad endeavor. I think M. Night Shyamalan kind of hit it out of the park with this one. And really to watch it through this movie's merits. So I think, if you are expecting an epic Shyamalan doing wrong, you're probably doing a disservice for the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
In viewing the movie that way. So with that, if there's nothing else, Gene, where can the good people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, Gene9892.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale, and you can also follow the show at The Youth Critic. And you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHC Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will be back with you very, very soon with The Lego Movie 2.
My bones break easily. I've had 94 breaks in my life.
But you have an extraordinary IQ.
This is not a cartoon. This is the real world.
No way.
And yet, some of us still don't die with bullets. Some of us can still bend steel. I've been waiting for the world to see that we exist. May I meet the Beast?
I hope for your sake that he likes you.
That sounds like the bad guys teaming up. A lot of people are going to die.
Don't do this.
Are you ready?
What do we call you, sir?
First name, Mister. Last name, Blast.